anywhere between 47 and 55%, while the Krasanovich favorability could fall anywhere between 42 and 50%. That means the McGriddle could be the favorite breakfast treat by a convincing 55 to 42% margin. Or there's an equal chance that the Krasanovich could actually be winning the hearts, minds, and arteries of America by a 50 to 47% margin. Yes, those are statistical extremes, but the extremes can happen, and they do happen. That makes me wonder why we even listen to any opinion poll that's even remotely close. While most media sources will at least acknowledge the margin of error, there is another measure of a poll's accuracy that is just as important, yet completely invisible to everyone who spent their college years at keg parties instead of statistics class, which would be me, the 95% confidence interval.
Oh boy, can't I skip this section on the CD? This sounds like it's going to get really complex and boring.
No, wait. The Los Angeles Times says that the confidence interval is such a standard measure that we usually don't even mention it. And while it's true that 95% is a standard number, it's far from standard knowledge that it even exists. It basically means that one out of every 20 polls doesn't even fall within the margin of error. Or, to translate even further, one out of every 20 polls is complete bullcrap. Now, I don't have any fancy polls of my own to prove this, but I would venture to guess that the polls the media hype the most, which are usually the ones that show drastic changes or unexpected results, are more likely to be part of that 5% group that represents bullcrap. Now, to be fair, the margin of error on that last guess of the bullcrap thing is 3%. But my confidence level is 100%.
I don't know what the hell he's talking about, but it is sure funny.
All the rules that bring the fabulous accuracy we've grown to know and love from opinion polls go completely out the window when the sample is either not truly random or not representative of the population. Sometimes this sort of thing is just an innocent limitation of the system. For example, about 1.5% of the population older than 18 isn't generally surveyed because they don't speak English. Another 5% of the population never gets surveyed at all because they don't have a phone. No phone at all. None. No ringy-dingy in the housey-wousey. Please. And you're embarrassed that you can't attach a file to an email. They got no phones. Losers. Even though innocuous oversight can be blamed for a lot of polling irregularities, sometimes you have to wonder if certain polls are tainted for other reasons. Like, oh, I don't know. For one example, among billions, look at the October 2005 CBS News poll that poorly attempted to measure the approval rating of George W. Bush. The media rejoiced, hallelujah, Brother Dan, in reporting on the poll that showed Bush's approval rating dropped to an all-time low level, while ignoring the fact that the polling sample was nothing short of ridiculous. Out of the 1,018 people CBS polled, only 25% were Republicans, 40% were Democrats, and 33% were Independents. Use your imagination about what the other 2% were. I don't know, might have been dogs. Does that sound like a fair sample that's representative of the U.S. population? Why, it does to me. And that's the CBS Evening News. Courage. If you extrapolate the CBS poll to reflect the 2004 exit poll party weightings, Bush's approval rating jumps from 34% to 38%. Wow, that's not exactly George Washington territory. It takes away the worst since whoever angle of the story and makes it just one more boring poll. A boring poll that does very little to help the media organization that commissioned it. CBS News' excuse was, well, we don't weight poll samples by political party. Just demographics, race, and age. But isn't there, or at least shouldn't there be, a moment before you release the results when you realize that your sample is so bad that you should just trash the whole thing and start over? One of the odd simplifications the media likes to present is that opinion is changing when a poll shows a higher or lower amount of support for an issue or a politician. For example, if support for, good God help us all, future President Lindsay Lohan is 53% one week and 48% the next, newscasters will undoubtedly state that support for the Lohan administration of the party fell by 5% after her no undies exit from Marine One. Put aside for a second all the other problems I've already pointed out that make the poll itself dubious at best because the media's characterization of the results isn't even accurate. I'll show you what I mean. I'll counter the low-end simplification with an even greater one. Let's say there's a new guy who starts working at your office. You want to find out how popular he is, so you go around and you ask 10 of your coworkers if they like him or not. 7 out of 10 say yes, giving him an approval rating of 70%. A month later, after the new guy was caught urinating in the coffee room and copying his extremities in the digital document center, you might decide to take a new poll to see how much his approval rating has changed. How would you do it? Would you go ask an entirely new group of 10 people, or would you go back to the same people from the first poll and see if their opinion had changed? Professional pollsters would go to an entirely new group of people, even though they have no idea if those people liked him in the first place. Seemingly, you'd get a much better feel for actual change if you picked a representative sample group and then just kept asking them every week. Unfortunately, that would probably just create a new industry of special interest groups that would find out who's in the samples and start lobbying them for votes. One of the main questions I have when I see a poll is this. What kind of person has a life so boring that spending 25 minutes on the phone answering questions from a complete stranger seems like a good idea? Aren't they likely to be the same people who are currently paying a few thousand dollars to the son of a former Nigerian king who promises to give them half of his family fortune? The percentage of people who actually participate in polls is pretty well known to be about 30%. That seems to be a pretty significant problem. Studies have shown that when the response rate is increased to just 60%, the average difference in answers provided is about 2%. Might not sound like much, but remember, Bush defeated Kerry in 2004 by just 3% nationwide. The same general concept that stops businesses like Bill Stucco Siding and Toilet Repair from calling you on your cell phone also stops pollsters from getting your opinion for their worthless surveys. And because many people, as much as 10% of the U.S. population and growing every day, or at least the polls say, have already converted to a cell phone-only lifestyle, millions and millions of people are left unmeasured by polling groups. Initial surveys from Pew show that those polled on cell phones are younger, more liberal, less affluent, and less likely to be married, and more likely to be a member of a minority group than those surveyed on landlines. Hey, you gotta love the irony of doing a survey to assess the inaccuracies of your surveys. However, one of the unexpected results was that young cell phone users were also more likely to support President Bush than young landline users. That's yet another small example of how something that's seemingly unrelated can chip away at a poll's credibility. Of course, small in this context refers to the complete elimination of the opinion of tens of millions of people. Many of the polls you hear about in the media were also done using listed phone numbers instead of the polling geek-approved system of random digit dialing. It doesn't sound like a significant difference, but using the phone book eliminates those with unlisted numbers. That excludes approximately 30% of the entire U.S. population, including 100% of those who've faked their own deaths to avoid uncomfortable calls resulting from drunken one-night stands. Could the American public hold opinions so pathetically shallow that they could be affected dramatically by simply changing the order of the possible options for their answers? Yes. Yes. To test this phenomenon, and I don't mean that in a good sense, a poll was done in which respondents were asked what issue mattered the most in deciding which politician to vote for. When health care was the first option listed, it was chosen as the most important voting issue by 24% of the respondents. When it was listed last, it dropped to just 15%. When family values was moved to the top of the list, it increased from 10% to 20%. Only the issues listed in the middle stayed around the same. For example, the environment was last both times. I'm sorry, Al Gore. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Whoever came up with that saying obviously wasn't a pollster. Because the wording of a question might be the single largest factor in skewing a poll from mildly accurate to as irrelevant as the presidential aspirations of Joseph Biden. For example, when people were asked about our missile defense system, it was supported by a wide 61 to 29% margin. But when the same question was asked with the caveat that some scientists believe it's unlikely the system can ever work, people opposed it. 56 to 25%. When instead told that the system might have a good chance of working, support became almost universal, 71 to 12%. But it's not just complicated issues such as missile defense that cause confusion. A 1993 poll showed that 34% of Americans either questioned whether the Holocaust ever happened or straight out denied its existence. That's a shockingly high response, right? Yes, but it was the confusing way the question was asked that led to the ridiculous results. This is the question and how it was phrased. Does it seem possible or does it seem impossible to you that the Nazi extermination of the Jews never happened? What? Huh? What? That question is filled with more double negatives than the coming life of Anna Nicole Smith's baby. Once the wording was cleaned up a tad on the question, in other words, once they fired the idiot who wrote it, more than 95% of people said the Holocaust either definitely or probably did happen. The other 5% were either brain dead, former Nazi prison guards in hiding, or named President Ahmadinejad. Because so many people are making up their opinions on the spot, the wording of poll questions is vitally important, yet so subjective that it renders an incredibly high number of polls completely worthless. People, look, honestly, they're calculating bastards. And while a lot of them are not informed on the topics they're being questioned about, that doesn't mean they're stupid. They know how polls get used, and they think about that when they answer. For example, let's say you had a one-night stand with one of the Proclaimers. Oh, they were great. And a pollster asks if you think the greatest band of all time is the Rolling Stones, U2, the Beatles, the Proclaimers, or Chumbawamba. ADD moment. You know. Come on. The Proclaimers. They're great. Remember they had nerdy twins who looked like the result of a botched stem cell research project as their lead singers? Nothing still? All right, gonna have to take my word for it. Wait, ADD moment. Chumbawamba, you remember them? Huh? Nothing still, nothing at all. No ringing of bells. Remember? It felt like something you'd hear from like the bottom of a drunken soccer stadium stampede. I'm the only one? Really? Now, obviously, you don't think the Proclaimers are better than the Beatles, But since you now have a 14-year-old son with geeky glasses and a ridiculously exaggerated Scottish accent, you'd vote for them anyway. Now, thanks to you and your horrible judgment on whom to be a groupie with, the poll has incorrect results, and your kid is still incredibly odd-looking.
What a nice little circle the media have put together.
They report only the bad news from the war, portray the religious as a bunch of snake-charming nut jobs, and present every conservative policy from Social Security reform to tax cuts as hateful, racist, and uncompassionate. Then, the same supposedly neutral organizations call people and ask if they support the policies they've been describing as evil. Shockingly, many average people feel some social pressure to give the correct answer and avoid appearing like hate mongers. That skews the polls against many issues supported by conservatives. But the best part is still to come. The media, the same group that influenced the opinion and then measured it, will now go on to report their own poll results as fact, thereby creating yet another story that will help persuade the next round of poll responders to hide their real opinions. Polling geeks call this type of reaction the spiral of silence. I call it how America works. Ever wonder why you start suddenly hearing a random song from someone like Randy Van Warmer on the radio again, seemingly out of nowhere? Most likely, it's because his song tested well in all the surveys that radio stations do with their listeners to find out what they want to hear. Occasionally, an older song tests really well, and then you'll start hearing it about every 20 minutes for a month. Then, invariably, new research will come out revealing that the old research on Randy Van Warmer was a fluke, and the station goes back to playing the same crap it was playing before. Research can be valuable, but only when good, experienced radio people interpret it, making your station your Randy Van Warmer source for 3 weeks is not really a good idea. No, really, I believe I've worked at that station before. No matter what the data says. The same thing is true of a public opinion poll. For example, the ubiquitous direction of the country poll is universally looked at as yet another measure of the president's performance. But think of a conservative who's more than happy with the president, but might be concerned about the direction of the country because of how it's turning away from religion. In fact, Republicans are routinely about 30 percentage points less positive on the future of the country than they are on the performance of George W. Bush. But it's all about how you translate the poll to the public. A less experienced person might look at the data and conclude that Republicans have turned on their leader, while a more seasoned person might realize that other things are in play besides a simple referendum on the president. Another way the media controls the message is by hand-selecting which polls gets reported. For example, March 18, 2007, two different polls of Iraqi citizens were released. The first, from USA Today, reflected typical media optimism about Iraq, including such positive stats as 9 out of 10 Iraqis saying they lived in fear, along with the uplifting anecdotal evidence such as a 38-year-old Iraqi woman said, "There's no life at all." But on the same day, the Sunday Times reported on a poll with a sample size more than twice as large as the USA Today poll that painted quite a different story. It showed that by, quote, a majority of 2-1, Iraqis prefer the current leadership to Saddam Hussein's regime, regardless of the security crisis and lack of public services, end quote. The poll also revealed that, quote, contrary to the views of many Western analysts, most Iraqis do not believe they're embroiled in a civil war, end quote. In fact, only 27% of Iraqis reported feeling that way. You take a guess. Come on. Come on, guess, you knucklehead. Which poll was widely reported by the U.S. media? Come on. Come on. I'll wait.
Bzzzt, oh, sorry.
Oh, no, you guessed right. Yeah, the one that made the Iraq War look bad. So, who cares? Who cares if polls are unreliable? Aren't they basically a little blurb in the bottom corner of the newspaper? No. Polls aren't just measures of opinion. They move opinion. Because most people base their views on so little information, polls wind up moving polls. When the only real piece of knowledge people have is a poll that shows overwhelming approval of an issue, they tend to approve of it too. Like the 2/3 of all Yankee fans who live outside New York. These people have fallen victim to what pollsters call the bandwagon effect. What's funny is that most Americans who look at polling results joke about those who answer, I don't know, or no opinion. But unlike the majority of respondents in most surveys, at least these people are being honest about their ignorance. The rest of us try to bluff our way through it. So, my solution.
My gosh, how much did you pay for this audio disc? How many solutions are you going to demand from me? This isn't easy, you know.
All right, try this one. Unlike many of the problems in this audiobook, this one is actually incredibly easy to solve. It doesn't involve any technical fixes for polls themselves. It just requires that the people who use them, mainly our leaders, get back to that outdated concept of common sense that many have somehow forgotten. If you're a leader, here's what you do when a poll arrives on your desk.
Oh, boy, look at this. Oh, man.
That's a great poll. Here's what I think we should do. Real leaders don't need real polls. They don't need to hire a polling consultant to interpret them or change their whole personality and agenda based on the results. And they especially don't need to follow polls to keep their paychecks coming in for another 2, 4, or God forbid, 6 years. No, real leaders live and die by what they think is right, and eventually the polls follow them. Section 12. Poverty Prozac.
Picture a poor person in your mind right now. Do you have it? Look. What does he or she look like? I see a tiny Tim clone, complete with soot on his face and a barely understandable English accent.
Hello. I'd like a little bit of chocolate, please. And could you do me a favour, sir? Please stop dressing me like Mark Twain, circa 1857. And also, is it me, or all these knickers made of burlap?
Maybe you pictured a frail child batting away flies in some horrifying landscape of a third-world country. Maybe you even saw Sally Struthers standing next to him, chomping on a double bacon Western barbecue burger while begging to send your daily coffee money to a country that will use it to fund a 19th palace of a corrupt dictator. Oh, I love the taste of bacon.
Regardless of the details, the poor person you pictured was probably A, hungry, B, unable to pay the bills, C, lacking a satisfactory entertainment system, D, without shelter, or E, smelly. In many places on Earth, those stereotypes may be true, but not in America. That's not to say that real hunger or poverty doesn't exist in America. They clearly do. And each case is as significant as it is devastating. But once you hear the facts, you'll realize that the crisis is it's really small, compared with what you've been led to believe. I hope this will serve as a giant dose of antidepressant poverty Prozac. Hunger is not really, truly an American problem. In fact, it's almost insulting to the rest of the world to allege that, even as a cursory glimpse at their reality, makes our worst problems seem like an incredible blessing. Of those Americans, defined as poor by the U.S. Census, an astounding 89% had enough food to eat throughout the year, and only 2% had bouts with hunger on a regular basis. Overall, 1 out of every 400 children skips 1 or 2 meals per month because of a lack of cash. In fact, the biggest food-related crisis for America's poor is eating too much of it. This country's porker problem doesn't discriminate between the rich and the poor, and studies have shown that people's intake of fat, vitamins, minerals, and protein is almost identical across class lines. America is truly the melting pot of pot bellies.
Yeah, give me a little cheese sauce with my bacon burger.
Sure, maybe the poor are figuring out a way to eat, but they can't possibly be paying their bills every month, can they? After all, I've never thought of myself as poor, but there have been months where I've missed payments, shifted debt, and stolen from my pimp just to make ends meet. Oh, I tell you, I made a lot of money as a hooker. I did. There was one night I made like $1.78. It was great. While those things certainly happen to the poor more than the general population, 7 out of 10 poor households were able to meet all of their essential expenses, mortgage or rent, utility bills, and important medical care for the entire year. About 96% of poor households avoided having their utilities shut off because of a lack of payment, and 99% avoided eviction because they couldn't come up with mortgage or rent money. Not only do almost all poor people in America have shelter, paid bills, and a decent living room full of electronics, but almost half of them actually own their own homes. In fact, the average dwelling of the American poor person has more square footage than the average overall residence in every European nation except Luxembourg. Remember, that's not the average poor person in Europe. That's the average person in Europe. And it's not as if the homes our poor live in are rat-infested hellholes. Only 2% of them have severe physical problems, and 9% have moderate physical problems.
Excuse me, sir. I'd sure like another bite of chocolate in a nice, sweet, kick-ass American home.
America is incredible for its short attention span. Many of the problems that we think are overwhelming today were facts of everyday life just a few decades ago. But instead of acknowledging that we've gone a long way towards solving them, our government scares us, our media depresses us, and there's absolutely no one with the motivation to recognize how far we've really come. I'm not trying to give you a rose-colored glasses view of the world. Just because a problem is small doesn't mean that it's not still a problem. Fortunately, this one is actually solvable, and the solution is simple. But I'm going to have to whisper it because it's way too politically incorrect. So turn down the volume here for a second in case somebody hears. Shh. The solution is work. Yeah. Shh. Quiet. The average poor household in America runs on only 16 hours of work per week. But it's not because there aren't any jobs. The 16-hour figure actually remains about the same regardless of how good or bad the economy is. If we could somehow get that number to, 40 hours, which is generally considered to be full-time, either through one household member working 40 hours a week or two members working 20 hours each, number crunchers say that almost three-quarters of children living in poverty would immediately be lifted out. It's at this point my mind starts to wander to the phrase that's constantly thrown around during an illegal immigration debate, jobs Americans just won't do. All right, here's the cardboard box edition of Extreme Makeover. Did you know you're almost homeless? Yes, it's true. According to Melissa Zawowski, a struggling mother, you are. Mm-hmm. She told CBS News, most Americans are just a paycheck away from being on the streets, being in a shelter.
Ah! Freak out!
Boop, boop, boop. Ooh, sorry, Melissa. That one's just not true. No. most Americans are definitely not a paycheck away from being on the streets. But if you think that CBS would bother to point out that Melissa is unquestionably wrong, you don't know the media very well. They ran her, quote, unchallenged, exploiting a struggling mom who was emotionally projecting her unfortunate situation onto the rest of America. Having even one person homeless is dramatic enough. Why perpetuate a false impression of nationwide doom? Maybe it's because most of the media believe it's their job to make you feel guilty for shoveling hot pockets into your mouth while watching that new plasma TV in your nicely heated home while someone else is out there struggling with not a single hot pocket. Most major problems in America eventually wind up on the desk of the head honcho. If the public perceives that the president or Congress won't solve them, then they eventually make a change to the other party to give them a shot. But for whatever reason, poverty just doesn't work that way. When cities suffer through decades and decades of the worst poverty America has to offer, they tend to just keep electing the same people with the same ideas over and over and over again. That sounds like a poor idea to me. Here are the American cities with the highest poverty rates, along with the percentage of time since 1965 that a Republican mayor was running them. Coming in at number one, Cleveland, Ohio. Poverty rate, 32.4%. Time a Republican was mayor since 1965, 38.1%. Number two, Detroit, Michigan. Poverty rate, 31.4. Times a Republican was mayor since 1965, 0%. Number three, Miami, Florida. Poverty rate, 28.3%. Time a Republican was mayor since 1965, 31%. And coming in at number four, with a bullet, Atlanta, Georgia. Poverty rate, 26.9%. Time a Republican was mayor since 1965, zip. You get the picture? And eight of the 10 cities with the highest poverty rates in the nation, Detroit, Atlanta, Buffalo, St. Louis, Milwaukee, Newark, Philadelphia, and New Orleans, have not had a Republican mayor since 1965. Look, I ain't saying that Republicans have the answer, but conservatives do. But why not give a conservative a shot? The government has estimated that there are about 754,000 homeless people in America. That is less than 0.3% of our population. While that means that more than 99.7% of Americans are not homeless, something that is never pointed out, of course, it doesn't mean we shouldn't take it seriously. But taking it seriously includes putting the problem into perspective. Ideally in a sober, non-hysterical fashion. That doesn't generate ratings or sell books. But hey, you already bought this one, so what do I care if you think this chapter's interesting? So, without the pressure of ratings or sales, here it is, possibly for the first time, the unadulterated truth.
Wait a minute. He just said an unadulterated. I think he's going to talk about adultery. It could have sex in this chapter. Keep listening.
Counting homeless people isn't exactly the easiest thing to do. While some homeless advocacy groups believe the government's estimate of 754,000 is too low, there is real reason to believe that it's actually much too high. Consider these qualifications buried in the report's footnotes. Some communities are making, quote, upward adjustments to the numbers and/or counting people who are not literally homeless. More than one-fifth of the total number of unsheltered persons in families in the nation were reported by just two communities, end quote. One community reported 14,000 unsheltered persons in families based on a survey finding that 2 out of every 1,001 households had homeless families living on their property. The sample size used to produce the estimate is extremely small, end quote. The second community appears to, quote, have included doubled-up families in this estimate, end quote. Some communities reported that their estimate included people considered to be, quote, at risk of homelessness. For instance, doubled-up, but not currently homeless. Even with these and other limitations included on both sides of the equation, the most comparable number of homeless in America is this. In 1996, there were 842,000 homeless people in America. In 2005, there were 754,157. That is a reduction of about 10%, and it can't be relied upon enough to say confidently that we're decreasing homelessness by that exact number, but at least it's safe to say that there was no increase in the homelessness during that time. To look at it another way, between 1996 and 2005, we added 31 million people to this country, and it's almost as if none of them became homeless. But that's not the end of this story. The vast majority of the 754,000 are not persistently homeless. In fact, only 170,000 are chronically in that state. Horrible circumstances can happen to everyone at some point in their lives. When wealthy persons have enormous financial difficulties, such as uncovered medical bills or losing a job, they dip into their savings. Those in the middle class might run up their credit cards. It's those who are already extremely poor who risk homelessness. While most are still able to avoid that outcome, about 77% of those who do wind up homeless don't stay that way. Take a minute just to admire yourself, America. The country that you've worked so hard to build, the country that you're constantly told has so many problems, can proudly say that just 0.07% of its entire population is chronically homeless. The pessimism patrol, though, isn't going to be derailed by some evil conservative analysis saying that the problem of homelessness in America is comparatively microscopic. To counter, they quickly jumped on a claim that there are 300,000 more homeless people than there are available beds in shelters. Yeah. There's only one problem with that assessment. The beds we have aren't full. Honestly, they're not even really close to full. On any given night in America, tens of thousands of beds that exist specifically for use by the homeless go empty. But wait a second. CBS said there are 750,000 homeless people filling emergency shelters through the year and spilling into special seasonal shelters in the coldest months. Right. Well, the seasonal shelters that they mention as if they're a bad thing are actually a simple result of supply and demand. During colder months, when more people want to get out of the weather, more shelters are added. In other words, the seasonal beds aren't needed the rest of the year. If somebody would have gone through all the trouble of actually reading a couple more paragraphs of this same report, they might have learned that emergency shelters were about 91% full for individuals and 87% full for families. Transitional housing for individuals was just 85% full and 72% full for families. Overall, about 16% of the beds that we have for the homeless go empty every night. That amounts to about 90,000 beds, not including the 30,000 more that the same government report said were in development as of early 2005.
Yes, that may be true, sir, but certain areas are not properly equipped.
Absolutely.
Could I have some chocolate?
Can resources be moved around and applied more efficiently to meet specific demand? Yeah, of course they can. But as you can see, the impression of a crisis caused by a lack of space for the homeless is a media mirage. Pretty much like the career of Ashton Kutcher. Yeah, I mean, I know, I get it. He still has a better career than I do. But I've never had that icky job of sleeping with Demi Moore. Damn. I don't know if you saw this episode, but it was like a really crappy version of Headline News Cribs when we took our television cameras out to cover the story of a homeless man who had staked out a grate in front of a posh Manhattan antique store as his new home. The owner of the store had filed a $1 million lawsuit against four homeless people, claiming
They are blocking my window and verbally harassing prospective customers of really expensive, ugly chairs.
Not to mention using the storefront as their own personal urinals. My first reaction, honestly, was to feel horrible for the homeless man, despite the fact that the sidewalk grate actually offered more square footage than most New York apartments. I mean, he had no place to go, right?
Boop, boop, boop. Ooh, once again, sorry.
Actually, New York City has a right to shelter law.
Oh, jeez.
Meaning that the government essentially is required to provide shelter for the city's homeless, if they want it. But that's the key. Because after looking at the stats, reading the laws, and talking to those who deal with the problem every day, there is only one sad conclusion you can draw. The people who sleep on the streets of New York City choose to do so. There are varying reasons someone may choose to sleep on the street, but a key explanation is that many shelters have this crazy requirement that you have to be sober when you enter them. While I know it's shocking to hear someone say it, I promised you the truth, so here it is. Some homeless people would rather be drunk than in a bed. And as a guy who pounded a gallon of Jack Daniels a week for years, that logic isn't completely lost on me. You'd be surprised at what seems like a rational decision when you're in that state. Homelessness in America is a quintessential example of the type of problem that humanity hasn't figured out how to deal with. It's a problem that is extremely small in scope, but incredibly brutal to those it affects, and it causes an understandably emotional reaction that usually guilts us into throwing more money at the problem. When that solves absolutely nothing, the cycle starts all over again. So here's my solution. Examples of how to solve this problem are everywhere. One Friday in October 2006, we were sitting in our daily meeting to prepare our radio show, and we saw this obvious target for ridicule, the Nobel Peace Prize. We were sure the winner was going to be some dirtbag human shield from the Kashmir region who took a bullet in the abdomen to prevent it from striking a tulip. After all, how could the award celebrate anything but some worthless gesture in a miserable region of the world that did absolutely nothing to bring peace to anyone?
ADD moment, Your Honor?
For example, I'd like to introduce you to the 2004 Nobel Peace Prize recipient, Wangari Maathai. He's a Kenyan environmentalist who won the award for... Oops, it's a girl. I mean, how did I not know Wangari was a woman? Anyway, she won the award for the campaign to plant trees in Africa. Now, maybe I'm just an evil warmonger who doesn't understand the path to peace, but trees don't exactly make me want to kill people any less. Maybe it's just me. In fact, the opposite, quite frankly. Trees give me the resource to create baseball bats to kill people with more efficiently. Maybe that's why we went into Afghanistan and Iraq. There just weren't enough trees to make us feel peaceful. Oh, if Saddam would have just lined the border with a few weeping willows, oh, he just might still be in power. But our Nobel bashing plans were actually derailed by the 2006 award winner, a guy named Mohamed Yunus. The interesting thing to me wasn't that I didn't know how to pronounce or spell his name. That's really nothing new. No, the amazing thing was, he was a businessman.
Wait a minute. How did a businessman get the Nobel Peace Prize? Oh, he must not have been a successful businessman.
No. Yunus had built a huge company that pioneered a form of lending called microcredit. He makes thousands and thousands of very small loans in extremely poor areas of the world. Loans as small as $9 and averaging only about $100. Believe it or not, that's enough money for a struggling family in these areas to start their own businesses. That sounds like poverty. Banks can't usually be bothered with loans so small, especially when the money is going to people who are thought of as too risky to ever make the payments. But that hasn't turned out to be the case. Payback rates on Yunus's microloans have been as high as 98%, even with no collateral required. Because the credit is given to large groups of families, and the entire group loses its chance at future credit if one family defaults. It's like peer pressure lending.
Polish up that trophy. I think we give it to him. Bada bing, we're done.
But wait, the best part of the story is that Eunice is making a difference within the bounds of capitalism. He's figured out an innovative solution, not just another pathetic attempt by the UN or another government to give money to a 13th world country whose evil dictator will just use it to buy fancy military uniforms to slaughter his people in style. It's the Dateline to Catch a Predator philosophy. It does a good thing, and it provides fabulous pedophile-bashing entertainment. It's the ultimate use of capitalism. Doing good while doing good business. That is our responsibility. Not as legally required taxpayers, but as humans. Enlightened capitalism gives as many people as possible the opportunity for success, which, despite campaign promises, is all this country ever has owed you. Over and over again, the private sector proves it's superior to government. That ain't hard to do, Jack. When Hurricane Katrina struck, it wiped out two bridges in the same general area. The bridge owned by a private railroad, CSX, completely rebuilt and back in use within 6 months. The other bridge, owned by the government, yeah, still about a half a year away from a partial opening after 16 months. While all levels of government lumbered to assist the Gulf Coast, 100 different companies donated at least $1 million. Walmart, the pinnacle of evil to people who complain about poverty, donated $20 million. 1,500 trucks of free stuff and 100,000 meals. Those figures don't even include the hundreds of millions of dollars generously donated by individuals. Conservatives, you know, the people who are constantly preaching about personal responsibility, give about 30% more to charity than liberals. Of the 25 states that donate more money than the national average, 24 of them donated their electoral votes to George W. Bush instead of John Kerry. It's the people who truly believe in the power of personal giving who do it the most. But more than just a political issue, charity is more accurately an American concern. A recent analysis of charitable giving by the Charity Aid Foundation found that Americans give more than double to the amount of charity than its next closest competitor studied, the United Kingdom. But in some ways, I think our generosity has blurred our focus about what really works. We donate so much money that we wind up creating giant charitable bureaucracies that rival the government in red tape and ineptitude. We need to get back to the philosophy of our grandparents. Back then, the neighborhood was king. People took care of each other because they cared about each other. They knew each other. Hunger, poverty, homelessness, they're not global problems. They're individual ones. The worst thing we can do is try to have some global entity solve them. As for the relatively few who fall through the cracks in this ridiculously successful experiment that we call America, the answer is simple. Get smaller. Get closer to home. Think locally. Help your family. Help your friends. Know your neighbors. The answer isn't in Washington. Quite frankly, it never has been. It's in the local church, the community outreach. Most important, it's in your neighborhood. Section 13. Parenting. The case for abstinence. As a proud parent of four, my gosh, I can't believe I have four beautiful kids. Well, three of them are pretty good looking, but one of them. Okay, anyway, one's age just over one, one's 19, and I have learned a few things. The most important is I have absolutely no clue as what I'm doing. Never did. Whole experience with being a father, kind of like a script for a Sandra Bullock movie. We're just making it up as we go along, hoping we can fix all the major errors later, you know? I love my kids more than anything. I do. Even the ugly one. But even the most casual observer might say that I've screwed him up in every possible way. Well, I do try to be a good parent. If they just had a good effort medal for parenting, I think I'd at least get a bronze. But even though I'm not a perfect parent by any stretch of the imagination, there are millions and millions of Americans who know even less than I do. And it's not that I'm talking directly to Britney Spears here. No, I'm not. But sadly, they're the ones that seem to have all the kids. Apparently, and I don't know if this is a scientific fact, but the lower your IQ, the more fertile your loins. I mean, I think they swim out of your pants and jump over to the girl. Even though you might want to try to write that one off as their problem, it's really not their problem. Unfortunately, it's our problem. Bad parents and the dysfunctional kids they raise are everybody's problem, especially when they become serial killers, nitwit socialites, or the waiter who never brings my lemon for my Coke Zero even though I've asked him 12 times. We're up to our neck in unfit parents, and the problem seems to be getting much, much worse. Have you been to a fast food restaurant lately and had the people behind the counter try to help you with a sandwich? You can see examples of it at school, on television, in the gossip pages. We're being assaulted on a regular basis by classless, impolite, ill-behaved, undisciplined little monsters. What's worse, someday their hormones are going to get the best of them. And then they'll produce classless, impolite, ill-behaved, undisciplined little monsters of their very own. Now, I'm not the only one that feels like something drastic needs to be done, and I, being the type of person who likes to take action, or at least, you know, likes to think about how I would take action if I got around to it, I do have a plan. I believe that prospective parents should have to apply for a baby license. Yes, yes, a license to procreate, if you will, before any child rearing is allowed. Sure. It sounds like the crazy plot of a really bad Charlton Heston flick, you know, or China's current family policy, come to think of it. Think about it for a second. You need to fill out an application to rent Geely at Blockbuster. You can't buy certain nasal decongestants without showing your ID to the pharmacist. You have to prove that you can park your car before they let you drive one. Yet any drunken yahoo with an urge to merge can bring another person into this world without any sort of upfront screening process. I don't know. I'm uncomfortable. How about you? Most major transactions in life involve some sort of cursory inquiry into your worthiness, but the life-changing act of baby-making? No. Mm-mm. Go ahead. If I were king of the world, I'd put an end to that immediately. With me in charge, the procreation license would become mandatory. Papers, please. As much as I hate government bureaucracy, this one is so important to me that I believe it warrants a new behemoth federal agency to oversee it all. The U.S. Department of Parenting. We could create it overnight without any kind of planning or foresight. You know, kind of like what they did with the Department of Homeland Security. After all, this is an emergency, America! And before the left coasters start whining, I'll have to protest and I'm almost out of hemp shoes. I'm not talking about regulating just the lower end of the socioeconomic strata. Sure, Deborah Duprone and her six kids by six different daddies makes me physically ill, but so does Tiffany McSpoiled and her children that she raised with the help of her 12 nannies. With my grand plan, everyone is equal under the law, and all prospective parents will be subject to the same scrutiny prior to the mating process. In fact, the Department of Parenting would actually give you a taste of parenting before you even conceive the baby. And here's how it works. A DOP, DOP, agent would come by, wake you up at 2 in the morning, and keep you awake until 4. Then, he'd let you sleep for about an hour before waking you again and keeping you up until it's too late to go back to sleep. Then he'd yell all morning, take a nap, and just as you were starting to doze off, he'd wake you up again. He'd start screaming at the top of his lungs, and then not tell you why. This would go on for, oh, let's say, 3 months. If you're still interested in parenting after that, You then move on to another agent, who will ask you some simple questions to determine how fit you are to be a parent. One of the questions that he will ask will just be, why? 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 That'll go on for about 3 days. Assuming the interview goes well, you're free to, you know, go to a back room at the Ramada for you and your significant other. Then, 9 months later, your dream of not getting a good night's sleep for the next 18 years will finally come true. Oh, it's magical. Unfortunately, you know, for you, unless I'm elected president or seize power in a bloody coup, my licensing proposal won't be debated in Congress anytime soon. So, in the meantime, if you're one of the millions of people determined to have kids...